This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you very much, John. Ladies and gentlemen, as President of Universities UK, I'm delighted to be here at this conference to talk about the important role of university-based research in our economy and in building the country's future prosperity and growth. Universities, as has already been stressed, play a central role in the research endeavour, and true to type, of course, I have to have a slide which shows you how well UK research has done in comparison to international comparators. But it's very interesting, as I was sitting there listening to Paul and to Alan, I suddenly thought, well, from Paul, the interesting heterogeneity of performance of the national outputs that seem to be completely unlinked to the heterogeneity of policy making in those particular countries. And I've written down here, back to the lab. You know, I don't write research papers. Nobody on the top table writes research papers. Policymakers don't write research papers. People in the Westminster and Whitehall bubble don't write research papers. And it's often, I think, when we're talking about policy and things like this, we forget about the football field where the game is actually played. And I was thinking back to my research group and to thinking back to what the people in my biochemistry labs are thinking about now as researchers. And what they want to be and what they need to be for us is highly able, highly inquiring, highly creative people, ambitious, who are given the resources and allowed to intellectually fly. And whatever the rights or wrongs of all policy, that should be the focus of what we're trying to ensure happens in this country. And I'd just like you to keep that in your mind up there when you're thinking about the various things that you're talking about in terms of policy and funding today. That's where the output occurs, in the biochemistry lab or in the Bodleian Library if it's arts and research. And it's just, I think, important to keep that focus in our mind. The excellent research conducted in our universities has wide-ranging impact and plays an important and diverse role in supporting economic growth, innovation and society more widely. And in this sense, it really is truly transformative. While my main concern today is about the economic role of research, we shouldn't forget the impact of the whole of the university's activities, for example, in producing highly skilled graduates, promoting social mobility, supporting regions and local communities. Indeed, the role of research is more often than not inseparable from these wider interactions and activities. Now, improving the links between universities and the wider economy has been an important policy imperative for a number of years now. We've had the landmark Lambert Review, the previous government's 10-year science and innovation strategy, and the excellent review by Lord Sainsbury, The Race to the Top, to mention a few. And evidence now is coming forward that this focus is paying off. The strong commitment to the research base that we've seen in recent years, combined with policies such as the Higher Education Innovation Fund and initiatives such as the Knowledge Transfer Partnerships, have helped to ensure that universities can support businesses to improve their competitiveness and productivity through the better use of knowledge, technology, and skills that reside within the UK research base. The most recent Hefke Higher Education Business and Community Interaction Survey shows that the total value of UK knowledge exchange increased to £3.09 billion in 2009-10. And that is this line here, the bottom line, showing it increasing to £3.09 billion. And these are the income sources: collaborative consultancy, contract research, CPD, facilities and equipment, intellectual property, and regeneration. There's also been increases in the volume of collaborative research and income from turning ideas into new products and services. Spending by small and medium-sized enterprises on research, consultancy, and other services provided by universities is growing. Indeed, a recent survey of their SME members by the Institute of Directors for Universities UK showed that 74% of SMEs had engaged with a university or HEI in some way in the last 12 months. In 2009-10, 273 new businesses were set up based on the research carried out in UK universities, and that makes a total number of active spin-offs, as I stand here, as 1,340. These companies employ about 17,000 people. They turn over nearly £1.8 billion during the year. It's clear to me that universities are putting their best efforts into stimulating economic growth and contributing to public services in challenging global conditions. This is good news, but we must always look to how to sustain and improve our position, particularly maintaining the excellence seen in our research base, which is the engine of the knowledge economy. The government's recent white paper acknowledged the important role that universities have in the economic and wider social spheres, but focused deliberately on changes in teaching funding to support a more student-centred system. We are promised a research and innovation strategy later in the year that will pick up a number of the issues covered in today's conference. So before that strategy, ahead of that strategy, I'd like to use this opportunity to outline some of the thoughts and issues that we should be engaging with in that consultation. The government has already demonstrated its commitment to this area, as has been mentioned already, by sustaining investment and ring-fencing the science and research budget over the life of the spending review. And I don't think any of us should underestimate what an important signal that is. It's an absolutely crucial signal, considering what was happening in the rest of the public sector. We would, of course, all have liked more of the steady growth that we've seen over the last 10 years, and it, of course, bears repetition that we still lag behind our competitors in terms of R&D spend. Here is R&D spend as a percentage of GDP, 2009, Japan, Korea, the United States, United Kingdom down here at about 1.9%, United States at approximately 2.8%. But within the current economic climate, we simply cannot underestimate the significance of the settlements, as I've already said. As Adrian Smith has said, we will come to look on the previous 10 years as a golden age for investment in science and research. The forthcoming science and innovation strategy should seek to consolidate this commitment and send a clear message about the importance government places on research as a driver for economic growth. We have our own responsibilities. We in the science and research community would do well to ensure we continue to speak with one voice about the importance of this overall commitment to research investment. We very easily fragment into our own sectoral or discipline-based interests, which I find is more often than not quite damaging. We should use the remainder of the CSR period to work together and do everything we can to demonstrate the value and importance of the research base in this country in preparation for the next CSR in 2014. In making this case, Universities UK's work with RCUK on the Wakeham Review and more recently Ian Diamond's report on efficiency and effectiveness in higher education have been about the sector demonstrating effective use of resources and value for money arising from this investment, and we will have to continue so to do. Alan has already alighted on research impact, and research impact will be vitally important, and our ability to make a credible case rests to a significant extent on developments in this area. Importantly, impact should not be seen as an agenda that has been foisted upon us. Whilst there are understandable concerns and debates about how to assess impact and get the right incentives in place, through mechanisms like the new REF, there has been a more fundamental shift taking place. Universities remain autonomous institutions and will so do. But sustained public investment in tough economic times has made us more visible and more accountable. And it could be argued that we, like many institutions, have to strive harder to retain the respect that was once naturally granted. The impact agenda is therefore something that should be internalised as a pivotal part of the sector's tacit pact with the public, in a sense with the taxpayer. Without grasping and leading this agenda ourselves, impact will always remain something that we feel is placed upon us, and we will be dissonant with what the public's expectations are and what our policymakers' expectations are. Many in the sector have already realised this, and I know that, for example, the REF impact pilots pleasantly surprised many, particularly those in the arts and humanities community, where the impacts demonstrated, including contributing to the creative economy, to national cultural enrichment, extending the global national knowledge base beyond academia, contributing to civil society, and influencing policy development, to mention just a few. A lot has been learnt from the REF pilot exercise about how to assess impact robustly, but it will be important to carry the confidence and commitment of the academic community in this process. Levels of investment and demonstrating impact are crucial, but the framework we have for funding research in the UK is also a very important factor in our success. The dual support system has already been mentioned. Its strength is that it reinforces autonomy and dynamism in our universities. This autonomy isn't simply a luxury, it's a key factor, and a continued commitment to the dual support and the block grant will be essential, particularly if we think about that biochemistry lab or that arts library that I described earlier on. We will, of course, have to be looking at ways which we can diversify our research funding, particularly from private sources. But there are important issues to bear in mind when so doing. We can do more to attract private resources, and we will do more to attract private resources. But this certainly shouldn't be seen as a replacement for public investment. There are strong public good arguments for continued public investment in research. But we mustn't forget that perhaps crucially, it is government spending that leverages private sector spending. A high-quality, publicly funded research base is a magnet for private and inward investment. Reducing government spending on research would therefore lead not to replacement with private spending, but to reductions. Furthermore, a policy framework that seeks to push universities solely towards maximising financial returns from its research through commercialisation and protection of IP, rather than the broader social and economic benefits for society, government and industry, may be counterproductive. As I've said in many places, there is no financial bonanza for universities here. MIT, which is probably the most successful technology and knowledge transfer university in the world, gets less than 2% of its income from this activity and does not budget for it because it is so unpredictable. European funding represents another opportunity. Through the framework programme, for bolstering the research base and for UK universities wishing to diversify funding and develop new opportunities. And we need to remind ourselves that we do very well. This is European Research Council awards by country, and you'll see that the UK is top. I'm sure this is a slide that's not shown very often in Brussels. And that reinforces, of course, the attractiveness and strength of the UK research base. Although for some institutions the relative levels of EU funding are quite small, the benefits of participating are significant, allowing them to share knowledge and build partnerships and critical mass across a number of countries within and outside the EU. The successor to the Framework Programme 7, and importantly the level of funding for this, is currently being discussed in Brussels. Current budget is €54 billion over 7 years, which is due to finish in 2014. And as I say, political discussions about the level and priorities are currently underway. It is proposed that the investment in R&D should rise to €80 billion from 2014, a significant amount of which would go to the framework programme's successor. This is a fantastic proposal, but one which is by no means guaranteed and, of course, could possibly be linked to the success or otherwise of two or three countries. But we need to make a strong case in political discussions around the future EU R&D budget, based squarely on the argument that this is an important investment in the future and for growth within Europe. Universities UK and the International Unit have a clear evidence-based strategy for supporting this case and for influencing developments. At EU and national levels, there's also a great interest in addressing the grand challenges, the big questions: climate change, energy, ageing, population, digital economy, and food security, and for supporting innovation in these and other growth areas through increased collaboration across platforms or through clusters. And these are some of the recent innovation initiatives that we have seen. particularly through our own research councils in Europe. We now have the Technology Strategy Board, which brings people together to support business-led innovation. The development of the new TICs, the Technology and Innovation Centres, to support UK's capability and innovation in specific technology areas, which have to date received around £20 million of government funding. Universities are at the heart of the first TIC to be announced, the High Value Manufacturing Technology and Innovation Centre. And if the amount of activity that the National Composite Centre coming to Bristol has precipitated through this initiative, then it's a really, really exciting area. At EU level, we also have the European Institute of Innovation and Technology, which links higher education, research and business sectors to one another in areas such as climate change and mitigation, sustainable energy and information communication technology. There are significant initiatives which demonstrate the important role that policymakers can play in supporting innovation and stimulating response to some of our biggest challenges. There is no doubt that in their forthcoming strategy, government will want to look at how they can build on these kind of initiatives. One of their biggest challenges is that the UK still has the lowest business expenditure in R&D, a lower business expenditure in R&D than the OECD averages, which presents a real challenge to create more innovative businesses and industries. And this slide shows business expenditure on R&D as a percentage of GDP in 96 and in 2008. And as you'll see, the UK it has quite a low business expenditure, which has not really increased in those intervening years, whereas in many of our competitor countries, the business expenditure on R&D is both higher and has increased. As I've already mentioned, universities are doing what they can, and there has been a lot of intervention on our side, the supply side. So the key question rests on the demand side, the absorptive capacity of business, the capability, capacity, and willingness of businesses to recognise opportunities to invest in developing the outcomes of publicly funded research is a real problem, and the Lambert Review, of course, highlighted that. Addressing this is easy, and further supply-side interventions are often the only levers available to politicians, alongside perhaps the creation of new centres, intermediary institutes, or platforms that can act as a catalyst for innovation. In doing this, there are some important things for the government to remember. Firstly, initiatives should not divert investment away from the research base. This would be counterproductive. Secondly, although there is good evidence of the role and importance of areas such as creative industries, and indeed how this is underpinned by universities, and they have shown consistent and average significant growth over the last decade, picking those areas, just picking an area with potential for growth and innovation can be difficult. Governments don't have a great track record of picking winners. Thirdly, there are a number of centres across the UK working on innovation, commercialisation research, which more often than not are not necessarily linked to their universities very closely. These will have to be identified and facilities and expertise contained within them supported, built upon, and links with universities increase. Fourthly, in doing so, we must remember that such activity is not only the preserve of research-intensive universities. As Paul demonstrated, it's different in different countries. Cambridge has a flourishing enterprise network, so does Teesside. Recognising the diverse roles and capacity of different universities to support innovation at national and regional levels is extremely important. My last point is that the regional dimension of what universities do will continue to be important. Universities are not mobile like private sector firms. They act as a stable attractor for investment and as a reliable and valuable resource within their local area. I've already mentioned a number of ways in which these interactions have been recognised and supported, and that different universities will play diverse roles. However, we are, to a degree, seeing a shift in policy. Innovation policy has been largely centralised and will be delivered mainly through the TICs and the Technology Strategy Board. With the abolition of the RDAs, we are also seeing the government developing mechanisms, other mechanisms that have the ambition to encourage private sector growth. The new model of local economic partnerships and regional growth funds are the vehicles for achieving this. The emerging landscape therefore presents a number of challenges. Universities are involved in LEPs and RGF in a number of ways already, but there is a key question about how we might seek to expand our role in this new framework without reliance on publicly funded economic development programmes. Furthermore, most knowledge exchange at the regional level has been focused on science technology and supported through RDAs. This will continue to be important in terms of support for high-tech industries, but current and future economic growth is also expected to come from the service sector. How can universities best respond to that? There is no doubt that universities will continue to play a vital role in this area, which is why UUK has seen it as a priority to understand this emerging environment and identify how government and others can get the policies right. We will publish work later this autumn to feed into the government's research and innovation strategy. In summary, therefore, it's clear that our universities are an important national asset, and the research they produce is outstanding by any measure. Furthermore, the progress that has been made to position this as a major economic driver has been significant. The role is now beyond doubt. In looking to the future through the forthcoming science and innovation strategy, the government should celebrate this and will be wise to build upon the success and the work with us to help unlock our further potential. Thank you very much.